Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is Dr. Felicitas Cort. She is a trained psychologist licensed in Venezuela. She has studied at the University of Pennsylvania and universities in Latin America. She has written various books on various subjects of psychology, and she writes articles for magazines, various venues. Good evening, Felicitas.
Good evening, Chaim. What a lovely music that you have. It reminds me of my radio talk show. I start with some Bach also.
No,
how are you?
Vivaldi's Four Seasons.
Vivaldi, okay. Well, they are very stimulating pieces, really. How are you?
All right, Baruch Hashem. So, Felicitas, what exactly is your background?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Chaim, for giving psychology the opportunity to be in your program, in your radio program. As far as I understand, it's your first psychology program, and it's very, very important. Psychology is the Cinderella of sciences, and part of my hat is to try to change that. And so my background is what they call evidence-based psychology, evidence-based psychotherapy. And initially it used to be called behavioral and cognitive psychotherapy. It's still, you know, if you look in the main classic books of that my field, it will be behavior and cognitive psychotherapy. But you can also see most recently the word evidence-based. And that means that whatever I do in terms of individual or clients or patients or groups is based on research. So we have a very clear-cut, even to the point of having manuals on how to deal with different walks of emotional difficulties, but also we do it in positive psychology. In my case, I work a lot in clinical psychology, which means the areas of anxiety, depression, what is called mood disorders, and other areas like when people have difficulties in couples or when students are not well in their, are not getting good grades. So I have a palette of several things that I work with my patients, but basically whatever we do, me or our field, is based on evidence, empirical research. So it tends to be very, very successful. It's not a panacea, but it's very successful.
When I was
I'll continue. While preparing the program, we decided that it would be a good idea to open the microphone so people could make questions. And the reason I did that is because it's very important. People are very afraid of talking about what to do with anxiety. And, you know, it's very common to have anxiety. One in every 10 Americans will suffer at some point of their lives a degree of anxiety. And the good news is that you can deal with anxiety in a very clear way that you can change things that are happening. So the area I work with, it has goals like changing the way of acting. For example, if you're smoking a lot, in order to smoke less, to change a way of feeling in case a person is depressed or scared or very anxious, so we help them lower their levels of anxiety. We also teach a way of thinking, so people who do not know how to solve problems, we can guide them to work with self-defeating thoughts. So it's a training, actually, Chaim. It's like teaching. It's not like, it's teaching this type of psychotherapy. The relationship is like, a teacher and a pupil. And we give information, and we even give some kind of homework, and we check from time to time, every time we see each other, again, how they're doing, if they're okay, if they've done their work for the week, or it's important to have a way of measuring whatever we are working with.
And when we open the microphones, the number to call in will be 714-333-3357. Let me repeat. When we announce that we open their microphones, the number to call in will be 714-333-3357, and we definitely want to hear your questions or comments. Now, I do have one question for you, Felicitas.
Yes.
Quite often, when somebody is depressed, gets to the point where there are a number of things that person can do, but is not quite sure which way to turn, and becomes almost like paralyzed, unable to make a decision. Is that one of the things that you deal with?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, we are with a very recent classification of mental, disorders or difficulties, and there is a name for this, what you're saying. It's called mixed anxiety depression disorder. So because it's very difficult, they're like married. You can be depressed but also anxious. And the way we deal with this is usually the format in working with a person is first an interview. You know, we have an interview, a very structured interview from one-to-one basis, and then there are questionnaires, specific questionnaires that will lead to a decision of what we will work on first. For example, if we're talking of anxiety, just mentioned, if there is more anxiety than depression, we can analyze, there is a form of anxiety, it's called generalized anxiety disorder, which means that, everybody has worries from time to time about finances, about their job, about health, about family, but people who worry excessively or they have a difficulty to control their thoughts and their thoughts become very unrealistic, then we have to evaluate how anxious, what levels of anxiety they have. And this certainly affects the physical symptoms. You get physical symptoms such as muscle aches, tension, soreness, sleepless nights, irritability. And Chaim, to our surprise, we know that usually women feel more those symptoms because women express it more with their body, and so they don't say, oh, I'm depressed, but they say, oh, I have a stomachache, or I have a headache, or I have... So the worry is very attached to physical symptoms, and when it persists for many months, then it's important that we work with that because people can get feelings of helplessness and think that that can lead, like you mentioned before, it could lead to depression, and it sometimes comes together with depression. So since we're going to be opening the microphone, I have a simple questionnaire that maybe some people would like to answer very quickly from 0 to 3. Only 7 questions, but for example, do you feel nervous, anxious, or on edge? So you can say not at all, or put 1 that is occasionally, 2 when it's more than 2 days, and 3 when it's every day. You know, it's by degrees. So you can, if you're every day feeling anxious, so you can put a 3. The other question, so that was the first question. The second question would be, do you think you're not able to stop or control worrying? So again, we go 0, no, yes, I can control, or 3, I can absolutely not control it. Then I'll go, like I said, there are only 7 questions, so bear with me. So the third one would be, if you're worrying too much, do you worry too much about different things all the time? So again, you can rate this from 0 to 3. And then the fourth question, do you have trouble relaxing? It's perfect for you to relax, or it's very difficult, so you rate it between 0 and 3. The fifth question is, are you restless all the time that it's for you very hard to sit still? So again, you do it from 0 to 3. And the sixth question is, do you feel becoming easily annoyed? Do you feel that you're irritable, that you get annoyed very frequently, occasionally, or not at all? That's question number 6. And the last question, we're talking about a very simple, friendly-to-use questionnaires. This can be much more complicated, but we're not going to do it in a radio program. So the 7th question is, are you feeling afraid as if something awful might happen to you? Again, you would put 0, no, I don't feel that, or 3, yes, I'm very concerned. So once you have all this, you add up. Obviously, if you ratings of the number 3, the total score is high, then you can say, well, it's yes, it's extremely difficult for me to deal. And in this case, we would say if the rating is very high, we can say that the person has a generalized anxiety disorder. And they don't have to get scared or anything, because it's like having, like you have a headache, or you have a, not necessarily diabetes, because diabetes is more a long-term illness. But anxiety disorders, they can be, if they're treated, you can learn to regulate your emotions and really, have very adaptive life. You can cope with it, and there are many ways to do it. So it's your decision to work on that and believe that and understand that out there in the science of psychology, there are many things you can do and you can overcome, and not think that you are subject, that your destiny is to suffer, or your destiny is to have a lot of worries all the time and there's nothing you can do about it. So that's completely wrong, and that's one of the reasons I'm in the radio with you at this hour, at this time.
One type of problem that I've come across quite often is somebody has various possibilities and they become so anxious they cannot make up their mind and end up doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
How would you deal with something like that?
Yeah,
how would you teach that person to make decisions, not to be paralyzed by the fears or whatever it is that causes them to do nothing?
Yeah, very good that you are asking me this, because anxiety, when you're anxious, you have 3 options. Either you get paralyzed, like you mentioned, or you have the flight response where you say, I'm going away, or I want to isolate myself, or I don't want to be with anyone. You really, you run away. And the other response is aggression. You can become very aggressive with the fight response, no? So fight, flight, or paralyze. When you are depressed, usually happens with what you just described, that people it's very difficult for a person to take decisions, and they're not ready to act. There are many symptoms. I didn't prepare that for today, but we can talk about depression another day, because that's a whole really a lot of things that we can talk about depression. And mainly what happens is depression is related to the way you think. If your thoughts are inadequate, and we teach what they call disruptive thoughts, we can detect them by, again, by questionnaire, by talking, by the interview, and we can learn what are those self-defeating thoughts that paralyze people. Once we detect these thoughts, and we have a whole, let's say, even we have manuals about this, then we can re-educate, we can change this, really reverse the way of thinking. And it's possible, but more difficult, because when a person is depressed, in order to get a person moving, you have to you use a lot of homework, behavioral homework, things to do. You have to get the person, you know, when you read general magazines, for the popular magazines, they say, okay, you can, why don't you do exercise? Well, it's pretty much, exercise is okay because it activates the body, and then that creates in the brain a certain substance that stimulates you to act. So just like exercise can help you to change your depression, there are many, many other things we can do with depression.
And if you have any questions, ladies and gentlemen, the number to call in is 714-333-3357. Any questions or comments, please give us a call at 714-333-3357. I realize everybody is busy cleaning for Pesach, but that's probably one of the things that causes some of the anxiety, some stress, some depression. Please give us a call and speak to Dr. Kort. The number to call in is 714-333-3357. Dr. Kort.
Well, let us
imagine somebody comes to you and says that they are very, very troubled. You know, they are not quite sure which way to turn, and we have a caller on the line. We're going to let the caller ask a question.
Okay.
Good evening, caller.
Hello, good evening. Yes, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Your first name and where are you calling from?
My name is Joanne, and I'm calling from New Jersey. And I just wanted to get a sense of this cognitive behavioral approach compared to the old style of analytics and know when problems are deep-seated and go back, you know, way into childhood, if these same skill sets of, you know, CBT and DBT and cognitive behavior training can really solve and help resolve and help the patient to improve, even though some of these issues are so deep-seated.
I appreciate very much your call, and it's a very, very good question. I see that you have information about the different therapies we have in behavioral and cognitive therapy, like DBT, which is dialectic behavior therapy, and other things that you mentioned. Let me explain something. I didn't get your first name, but anyway, let me explain that.
My name is Joanne.
Joanne, let me tell you that this is entirely a different approach. We don't believe, there is no scientific evidence that problems are deep-rooted like in other forms of psychotherapy. When we work with a specific behavior or specific emotion or specific thought, we stay in the here and now, and through questionnaires and interviews, we design a plan, a strategic intervention, a therapeutic intervention, and we see very, very successful response. I was trained by in the psychoanalytic therapy in Venezuela. Actually, the hardcore psychoanalysis with Melanie Klein. And then when I went to Philadelphia and at the Department of Behavioral Science, I was very, very impressed to the fact that many of our patients came from the psychoanalytic therapies, and they use this kind of therapy like their last resort. And even though I was initially very psychoanalytically oriented, throughout my experience in the Department of Behavioral Science with a great professor who, I mean, he really changed psychiatry before and after. His name was Joseph Wolpe. I was very surprised to see the changes in their emotional makeup. So there is the culture of psychoanalysis is very embedded in the way people approach psychotherapy. And, it's a very interesting, one always learns about, oneself. But if you want to work with specific situations, and you want to see some change, obviously you can check the statistics and you see we have a great deal of response and success throughout the different centers in the world, like talking from Australia and England and the USA, and unfortunately this type of psychotherapy is not disseminated much in New York, to my surprise. Again, this is one of the reasons I'm very happy to do this radio program, because I'm surprised because here in New York they have the headquarters of the organization of, you can check, it's Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Psychotherapies. And to my surprise, I've been not too long in New York, but wherever I go, it's not that well known, and that's one of that's a big contrast, you know, having all that information in the universities and have all this information in, let's say, in our experience in our research, and then when you go out there, people are not aware, and it's very important to know that besides psychoanalysis, you have behavioral and cognitive psychotherapy, and you also have other kinds of therapies which are called humanistic psychotherapies, which is another branch, another way of working with people. But actually, we have 400 psychotherapies throughout the psychology. So we have to be sure when a person sees psychotherapists, you have to know what you're getting into. You have to ask, what kind of therapy am I getting? Am I getting a psychoanalytic? Am I getting a behavioral? And then you can check. Nowadays, we have an informed world. You can find out what statistics they have for resolving whatever the issues you're trying to deal with.
So for example, although you believe in working in the here and now with these behavioral cognitive techniques, are you saying that when there's, let's say, a deep-seated, trauma of physical abuse as a child or something like that, that's inhibited this person from being able to enjoy a full relationship with a significant other, that this modality alone may not be sufficient in order to help this person move through this and be able to enjoy a full relationship? Or are you saying that, no, we can work in here and now and the past is irrelevant? It's not that it's irrelevant, but it's no longer important in terms of how to get this person to a functioning, better place so that they can share a relationship.
Yes, Joanne, I appreciate very much your comments, and you are quite savvy. Congratulations on these things. No, I did not come across fully with what I'm trying to tell you. I'm trying to tell you that yes, behavioral and cognitive psychotherapy can deal with trauma. No, we don't need to go to other kinds of therapies. When you deal with trauma, it's called post-traumatic stress disorder, And as a matter of fact, we have one of the most, let's say, very famous groups that work here with what is, it's called exposure. That intervention is called exposure strategies. And during 9/11, this group that works in Philadelphia, they were all throughout the U.S. Using the exposure therapies to help people who had experienced the terrible, you know, aftermath of 9/11. So terrible events which create feelings of helplessness or horror or fear can be dealt, contrary to the fact that we think we should bury it in the past. No, we stay in the here and now, and we stimulate the person to work with this. That's why it's called in vivo exposure, where the person describes their trauma, and the psychotherapist walks with the person, guiding them to work to revive whatever they experience and not let it sink in the oblivion. Because when you, if you don't work with that, that stays in a certain part of the brain, which is called the amygdala, and then it can be triggered any time. This is what happens with a lot of people that come back from war, you know, from our soldiers. So no, absolutely not. On the contrary, I don't think. Professor Wolpe started working with exposure therapy because he had been working with trauma clients for a long time after the war, and he was not successful. And he said, okay, I'm going to start doing some research to change this because I don't see people responding or getting better with psychoanalysis, you see? So no psychoanalysis. If you inquire further, you'll see that as far as trauma particularly would not, it gives you the information, but it's not, it doesn't help you overcome it.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that with eating disorders and some other things, this is also very useful, this technique.
Well, with the eating disorders, for sure, yes, I see you're quite informed. It's more complicated, believe it or not, with eating disorders. We work in conjunction with a psychiatrist because this can lead to the person with a severe anorexia, for example, or bulimia. You have to use medication. It's in certain degrees when a person is with severe symptoms. So we don't work in the clinic, in the psychotherapy one-to-one. Not necessarily would I work only with by myself with a person with eating disorders, because my experience is that you have to, it's good to do it in a group, like the social worker, the psychiatrist, and the clinical psychologist. Mm-hmm. It's more difficult to treat eating disorders, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And is this useful with OCD as well?
OCD, which obsessive compulsive disorders, yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your questions. They're helping our program to come along very nicely. There have been brain studies with brain imaging and scanning that teach that you can change actually the brain using behavioral and cognitive psychotherapy intervention. It's really fascinating when you see how when you use a very systematized way of working with a person with obsessive-compulsive disorder, you can change their brain morphology, the structure of the brain. And I'm not saying it's easy. You will never hear me say in any of these interventions that it's easy. But if you, you know, when you have the, the background of using the questionnaires, the interviews, And it's a learning experience. So the person has to know what they're in for. And we tell them, we're going to do this A, B, C, D. Are you willing to do it? That we do with trauma. We do it with obsessive compulsive. Whatever we work with, we're companions in changing the person's behavior. We're coaching their change. And it's up to them to follow our experience, our training. It's not that we're better, you know, we're not looking down.
Are you referring to things like exposing them to the very things that that they're compulsive about or afraid about and confronting those phobias or those perseverations?
I feel a bit uncomfortable, yes, because we could, if it's a simple obsessive-compulsive disorder, we can expose them to them. Let's say if you're afraid of getting germs, so we teach the person to work with a faucet and, you know, and not wash that frequently. But it's not so easy, you know, if we, I don't want to give the impression that, you know, like Reader's Digest psychology, there are ways that you can work with this and you can change it. But especially with obsessive-compulsive disorder, it would take longer. Usually obsessive-compulsives are okay with their symptoms, and they don't even go to the therapist because they see, well, that's the way I am, you know? So it's one can't generalize. But this kind of therapy, it's really every year, every semester, we have new research, and so it's in a constant evolution and change, and that really is very rewarding and stimulating, and you know, it has been very successful.
Thank you. And my final question is what's the usual course of treatment, and how successful is it long-term in terms of them maintaining the optimum behaviors that they're trying to achieve?
Well, that's a very profound question. Don't work very long with patients. If you see the person once a week and you expect, let's say, 6 months, a year, something like that, but depending on what, for example, let me qualify that. If the person has a phobia, what they call a simple phobia, suppose you have a fear of dogs, we can extinguish the fear of dogs in a question of hours. So some disorders or some difficulties can be dealt with very, very quickly. Also, let's say toilet training or with children or that say, for example, we say toilet training in less than a day. So you can, other things are more difficult. If you're dealing with obsessive compulsive disorders, you have to really set up a plan that has several stages. And with trauma, the same. On the other hand, with a panic disorder, which is very, very scary. People, when they get panic disorder, let me explain that to Haim or to the audience, is that you think you get a severe anxiety attack that you think you're going to die any minute, or that you're going to have a heart attack, and you feel so very, very bad that some people go to the emergency, the hospitals, and they say, hey. I'm talking about my experience in Venezuela. Here, I think people are more informed and they know what a panic attack is. But in Venezuela, for example, they don't. So they rush to the emergency and the doctors say, hey, go home, you have nothing. No, it's wrong. They have something, but they don't have nothing. They don't have anything physically. In a panic disorder, you can the interesting thing about a panic disorder, it's very, very scary, but it really does not do, absolutely, it doesn't do any harm to the person. Zero harm. So once the person learns that even though the levels of anxiety were very, very high, it's not harming them, not in physically, not mentally, and then we can reverse the whole how they, the whole symptoms of the panic attack. And you wouldn't believe it, but one of the first approaches is to breathe, to learn how to have a profound diaphragmatic breathing. And sometimes just with breathing, I mean, let's not make it so simple, but the beginning is to breathe adequately with a profound, a deep diaphragmatic breathing. Yes.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Joanna, for your questions. I'm sure Chaim and I were very pleased that you called
us. Actually, I was totally fascinated by the conversation between you two ladies. The caller, Joanne, sounds very, very well-informed, and I thank her for being on the program. And I thank you, Dr.
Definitely.
Ford. We're just about out of time. But tell me, how does somebody get in touch with you? How do we connect with you?
Well, I am presently, what I do is that I work with groups. I do what you would call, I do workshops on what is anxiety, the information of the anxiety disorders we just mentioned, or work with it's called mindfulness with an experience of meditation and relaxation. And let's say individually from a one-to-one basis, since I am from Venezuela, I have a Venezuelan license. I could only at this point see Venezuelan clients or patients. But in groups, I can do that definitely with any group that is interested, if, you know, people of 5-10 people get together and they want
to
have more information.
And how do people get in touch with you? How do we find you?
The way to find me is you can email. My email is Felicitas, F-E-L-I-C-I-T-A-S, K-O-R-T. So it's my first and last name, Felicitas, F-E-L-I-C-I-T-A-S, K-O-R-T, and then at gmail.com. And I also have a phone number, if you like.
Yes.
Anyway, it's in the internet. It's 212-933-4819, and I'd be happy to talk to you about this fascinating area of psychology.
Okay, and do you have a website?
Yes, I do, but you're going to have to read Spanish. My website, again, is my name, www.felicitascord.com. But I do have a little bit of English, some English information about what I've done so far. But in the Spanish aspect, my website is very, very complete. I have some videos about violence, about how you analyze behavior, about anxiety and many other things. And also I have a few of my radio programs that I had time. I had a radio program in Venezuela and here in the U.S. also. The one I had both in Spanish, actually. So you would have to read or speak Spanish to understand that part. But the English section, from now on, it will continue being more in English than in Spanish for sure.
And are any of your books in the process of being translated or published in the United States?
There is a book published in the U.S. It's called The Human Potential Movement, A Behavioral Point of View. It was published just many years ago. And I have no intention, Chaim, to translate it. My experience in translating books taught me that it's better to write one. So I am going to write in English as of now because I'm living in the U.S. and I'd be happy to write in English. My 5 books are in Spanish, except that one that I tell you, I don't know if you can find it. It's called The Human Potential Movement, A Behavioral Point of View. And
it on Amazon and I could not find anything.
Well, three of my books were in Amazon, but maybe I have been going to TV programs. Maybe they're out of it. I really don't know.
And you know, unbelievable, but right now in Venezuela, which is undergoing a very, very terrible political situation now, and also with we don't have paper. So my editor said, well, what are we going to do? Your book is, you know, it was, we wanted to do the second edition, and we don't have paper.
Right.
So I'm in conversations to do it here in English. I mean, no, here in the U.S., but again, it would be in Spanish. Yes.
Okay. And it was a truly fascinating conversation. There were a lot of subjects I would have liked to broach, but unfortunately, Father Time is against us. So we're going to have to do it again, and I hope we will be able to do it soon.
Thank you very much
for
the invitation, and just to leave with the audience that with behavioral and cognitive therapy, what we do is educate ourselves on how to get better skills in our emotions, in our way of thinking, in our behavior, and it works. It really works. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and good night. Good night,
okay,
one
good
and
night.
All.
Okay, very good. Nice meeting.
Thank you. Nice talking
to you.
It was a pleasure.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.